grown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods, food, and original works of art, located in the southeast lot of Lincoln Square, downtown Urbana. Information at 344-2444.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us here on the show. We're also pleased to welcome back to the program Dr. Robert Bocek. He is a pediatrician. He is with us here on this program once a month and has been for a long time now. Back in the dim and distant past, we decided that people would always have questions about children's health, so we thought this would be a good thing for us to do on a regular basis every month. And we built it into the schedule, and that's what we do. It's an opportunity for you here to ask questions about whatever might be on your mind, as long as it has to do with children's health. Can be concerns about your kids, grandkids, nieces, nephews, what have you. We've talked about a lot of different things on the show, common childhood diseases. We've talked about immunization. We have talked about things like developmental issues and behavioral ones, all kinds of things, sleep and, anything that you can imagine talking about with a pediatrician, we could certainly do on this program. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Good morning. It's good to be back.
Well, we're at that time of year where we're sort of in between the seasonal crises. We're done with flu, long done with flu and cold and stuff. And maybe if people are lucky, we have passed a little bit of the spring allergy peak, although there are some people who are going to be uncomfortable until we get a hard freeze next fall. So, and it hasn't been terribly, terribly hot. What do we talk about?
School physicals, sports physicals, camp physicals. I was reminded by my former office again that, the lists are filling, so plan ahead and, don't call the week before camp or the sports starts or school starts.
Get in early.
Call now.
Yeah, all right.
And get that scheduled. The other thing I think that's newsworthy is we had a case of meningococcal meningitis here on the U of I campus. Mm-hmm. And I think it goes to what we were talking about in the previous couple of shows about the new meningococcal vaccine and how important it is, particularly for those who will be starting college and will be living, particularly those living in a dorm where things are very close, contact is very close. It is recommended again that, all kids who are going to college, especially if they're going to live in a dormitory, received the new meningococcal vaccine. So I think this unfortunate case just punctuates it.
Yeah.
You know, again, is it a surprise? I think we have something like 30,000 students at the University of Illinois, and I don't know how many live in dorms. And I think, again, this one case is no reason to be particularly alarmed. I think, there's about 15,000 deaths a year from meningococcal meningitis. And I think in a population like the university, I don't think there's any reason to be alarmed. But again, this vaccine is there. Hopefully, it will eliminate any cases. I don't think any vaccine's that good. But certainly take advantage of it if your child is going to be starting college this fall.
And just for sake of information, how close would you have to be? What sort of contact would you have to have? Would you have to kiss the person? Would you have to use their toothbrush? Could you, if you drank out of the same glass? It's more than just this being in the same room, isn't it? Or is it?
No, it's not like mono where you need to share saliva, if you will. Just being close, within coughing distance, can do it. The other thing is, who's carrying this germ? You could be or I could be. During the season, about 10 or 15% of the population is walking around with meningococcal meningitis in their throat. And again, most of them aren't going to come down with the disease at all, but maybe, and I don't think we know for sure, if you get it, are you going to carry the bacteria in your nose and throat? Or are you going to come down with meningococcal meningitis? And I'm not sure anybody knows really what makes, that one in 100,000 or whatever the number is who gets it in their throat come down with the disease, and which one just carries it around their throat for a while and then just gets rid of it, sheds it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we've talked about that with some other thing. With strep, I guess maybe was one of the examples you said. You know, if we go out on the street and we walk up to people randomly and said, look, would you mind if we did a little throat culture, that we would find that there were people who had strep. And then if we said to them, so how you feeling? They'd say, I'm okay. You know, so there are asymptomatic carriers of that. And there may be probably some number of things, some list of things that people could be carrying around that can make a person sick, but right there at that moment are not picking that person sick.
Yeah, but these people are probably, again, shedders of it, sources of it for other people, and it's just the way it works.
Yeah. Okay, well, we have several callers here lined up ready to talk, and let's do that, starting with someone listening in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Dr. Bocek?
Yes.
I've heard about the sleep needs of elementary school children and how often kids don't get enough sleep. What do you recommend, though, for the middle schoolers and high schoolers? How much sleep do you recommend, say, a sixth grader or a ninth grader gets?
You know, I don't know the numbers, and the numbers are out there, and I'm not completely sure where these numbers came from. You know that, somebody should get 8 hours and 15 minutes of sleep. And I think what we need to say is, you know, when this child seems, at some time they've got to turn off TV, they've got to turn off the computer, and when there seem to be, watch their behavior maybe, when they're getting kind of cantankerous, a little grouchy, a little short-tempered, maybe that's time for them to go to bed.
All right.
And, I'm not sure I believe in the numbers.
Okay.
Because I don't know where those numbers came from, so I think you have to watch their behavior. And I guess probably 8 hours is a good number.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go to Charleston, and that would be line number four. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask about a bump on the back of my 5-year-old's neck. It's not in the center of the nape, but to the side.
Okay.
And 3 weeks ago, I took him to the doctor, who felt like two things were going on, a lymph node, and because there was a pimple with the white head, probably a ingrown hair.
Okay.
So an antibiotic was prescribed, and my son took that for 10 days, and it did dry up the head a little bit. Although it's still there, it's smaller. So I took my son back to the doctor because the bump is still there. And the doctor feels like it could take, you know, maybe as long as 6 months for this lymph node under the pimple to go away. Do you have any experience with this kind of thing?
This is a very frequent problem. And lymph nodes, again, are infectious fighting organs, and we've got I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of them in the spread all over the body, and very frequently, where parents are going to notice them usually is in the neck, either underneath the jawline or very frequently toward the back of the ear where the bump of the bone is. And certainly whenever there's an infection going on, even a trivial infection like an infected hair follicle, the local lymph node's going to get involved, and the body's going to say, hey, we got an infection going on here. You need to make some cells that will help fight this infection. So this lymph node dutifully does its job, and it makes cells. And as you can anticipate, as it's making cells, it's going to enlarge. Oftentimes, acutely, although I doubt in this case this lymph node was ever tender, but oftentimes, say with a sore throat, with a strep throat or something like that, these lymph nodes will be slightly tender.
Uh-huh.
And occasionally the lymph node itself will get overwhelmed with bacteria and get infected, and then it gets very tender and very large. But these lymph nodes are enlarging to make more cells to do their job, and it just takes a long time. It takes weeks for this lymph node to shrink back down to its previous size.
Right now, it's about the size of a small pea.
Okay.
And that seems big to me.
That's tiny.
Oh.
That's tiny. And often what I used to tell parents is, hey, if you can feel it, probably don't worry about it. If you can see it, worry about it.
Okay.
But no, a pea-sized lymph node is, you know, and I'll bet you if you feel around your child's neck, you're going to find a, you're going to find more of them. You're going to find a bunch more of them.
Okay.
In various places. And again, if you have to look that hard for them, they're probably of no significance at all.
Okay. So if it takes months, don't worry about it.
No. And that's, you know, and again, that's presuming something else doesn't, you know, that's presuming another hair follicle doesn't get infected, or an ear doesn't get infected, or a throat doesn't get infected, or something doesn't get infected that will cause that lymph node to have to go to work again and enlarge again.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The doctor felt that as long as he can move it around a little bit,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't hard and immovable, that was fine.
Yeah. Okay. And what, you're worried about cancer, aren't you?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, usually the cancerous lymph nodes, number one, they feel icky. They just have a different feeling. They kind of feel lumpy and firm and hard, and they don't want to slip around.
Mm-hmm.
And again, those are usually big lymph nodes. You can, you don't have to feel for them. You can see them. They stick out at you.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I guess I would like to say is cancer lymph nodes in kids happens. But it's by no means a common cancer in kids.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you for the information.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. Let's continue. And our next caller is going to be back in Champaign, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Couple of questions. One has to do with herpangina.
Herpangina, okay.
Herpangina. My son just got it. This week he's better now. But there was a lot of confusion. I mean, I told some neighbors and friends, and they were thinking it was hand, foot, and mouth disease. They think it's the same thing. I got confused as to what it is.
Okay.
And also, the other thing was that people mentioned that, well, if he gets it once, he won't get it again. And is that correct?
As far as I know, yes. I think there's, yeah. Well, maybe I better hedge my bets and say I'm not sure. Herpangina is caused by a Coxsackie virus.
Okay.
I believe hand, foot, and mouth disease is also caused by Coxsackie
virus. So is that why virus. People get confused as to what it is?
Yeah. But they're much different, aren't they?
Yeah, because all he had was just fever for a couple of days.
And a sore throat.
And a sore throat.
Yeah.
And he's fine.
Where with hand, foot, and mouth syndrome, they don't have a sore throat so much, but they'll have sores in their mouth.
Right.
And they have this funny red rash, sort of sores on their hands and feet.
Well, that's what people were saying, and I said,
he
has nothing like that. And I did take him to the doctor. That's why they said it was the herpangina.
Yeah.
And that, you know, just treat him with, you know, for pain, maybe a little Advil or Tylenol, and then otherwise just make sure he takes his liquids, and then he was fine in 2 days.
Yeah. It tends to be a rather mild disease.
Okay.
As far as I know, everybody survives it.
Okay, so it's not the hand, foot, and mouth.
No.
And now, so he could possibly still at some point get the hand, foot, and mouth thing.
Yes.
But maybe not the I can't say that word.
The herpangina.
So he may not get that, but you're not quite sure if that's the case.
Yeah, I can't remember for sure. I don't remember how many Coxsackie viruses there are and that can cause the disease.
Okay. All right. So now he's better. But here's another question with regard to kind of his eating habits. I was told some time ago that so long as he's eating one good meal a day, he's probably okay. And if he's gaining weight and he's peeing and, you know, having bowel movements, then he's okay. But I kind of worry because sometimes he doesn't eat everything or, you know, kind of, and he's only 11 months old. So
okay.
I'm not sure if I should compensate when he doesn't have, like, a good dinner. Should I give him more liquids? Or so long as he's gaining weight, I shouldn't worry?
As long as he's gaining weight and happy, don't worry.
Okay.
If you feel confident about yourself as a mother, and I feel confident in you from talking to you this just briefly, that you are offering him a good diet.
Okay.
Then he will take care of himself.
Okay, so I don't have to expect him to eat everything at every meal.
No.
Okay.
And do you?
Well, you know, I was brought up that way.
Clean your plate, yeah.
Clean your plate.
But now as an adult, now that you have choice, now that you're in control, don't you have days where some days you're really hungry, and other days you're less.
That's going to be fine. Now, the other question, since he's 11 months old, how about, introducing milk? How will that? He hasn't had his 12-month checkup yet, and I always heard that you wait till then to give him regular milk.
Oh, milk. Okay.
He's been on formula. I nursed him till about 8 months, and then he's been on formula pretty exclusively since.
Okay.
And so I was now trying to figure out, should we slowly introduce milk, or, I know some kids at his daycare also are already younger, about his age, are starting to drink milk, regular milk.
I used to use 9 months. But what formula is he on?
The Isomil.
Okay. Why was he on Isomil? Okay.
He liked the taste better.
He liked the taste better.
He tried the other kind, and he took the other kind, but he just didn't like it as much.
Okay. But he didn't cramp. He didn't vomit. He didn't have diarrhea.
No, nothing like that.
Okay. So he probably wasn't milk sensitive.
I don't think so.
He just
seemed to drink this better, take it better than the other stuff. He just didn't. He would take it if he had to, but he just didn't take as much. Once we switched it to the Isomil, he just loved the taste.
Okay.
Just kept drinking it.
Yuck, he's unusual, baby.
Yeah, because that stuff smells terrible.
It does. Smells like chicken feed, doesn't it? I think probably what I do is I just give him a cup of milk.
Okay, and just let him try that and
see
how he likes it. And no, is it skim, whole, 2%, doesn't matter?
Usually what's recommended is whole milk.
Whole milk, okay.
Yeah, still a fully fatted milk, so he has adequate fat in his diet.
Okay.
I guess the other thing I will say is most kids, when they leave the bottle, they seem to have the attitude of milk belongs in a bottle.
Uh-huh.
When I leave milk, I'm going to eat yogurt, I'm going to eat cheese, I'm going to eat dairy products. But don't worry if he cuts back his milk intake significantly.
Okay.
And increases his dairy product intake to make up for it.
Okay. Well, we have been giving him formula in the sippy cup.
Okay.
So I don't know if that's going to make a difference or not, maybe giving the milk in the sippy cup more than in the bottle. I don't know. But just try that and just see. And if he cuts back a lot, is there something we should supplement with water, or?
I don't think so, because it seems what happens to these kids is their diet changes. I am not dependent on milk anymore for my calories. I will take milk as part of the food pyramid, if you will.
Uh-huh.
But I'm going to start branching out into more meats, more vegetables, more other foods.
Okay.
So the food pyramid is going to become my goal now, rather than a milk diet supplemented with other foods.
Okay. So he might just do that.
Yeah.
And that'll be okay, so long as he's gaining weight.
So long as he's gaining weight, so long as he's feeling well, so long as he's acting well.
Okay, and that's what to look for.
Great. Yes.
Okay, well, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Right, thank you.
Back to that lady you called earlier about the sleep. I don't have an answer. I'm not sure I believe these. At such and such an age, you need 8 hours and 15 minutes. And I think, again, watch your child. How's your child feeling? How's your child acting? How's your child doing at school? And if the answer is, my child is active in sports, he's doing well in school, he's feeling well, he's probably getting adequate sleep.
Hmm. Okay. Well, one of the things that we know is that, well, there seems to be some general recommendations for adults saying that it would be good if everybody got, I don't know, 8 hours or 9 hours or something like that. And, of course, most of us don't. But we also know that there are some people who seem to be long sleepers and short sleepers, some people who really seem to need more, and some people who can really get by on less. Do you see that kind of variability in children, too?
Yes.
Yes.
And I think, and again, I think, look at the child, not the clock.
All right. Let's talk with someone else. This caller in Belgium, line number 3. Hello.
Good morning, sir. I'd like to make a comment on some of the news that's been on recently that deals directly with child care. Earlier this week, we heard on the program about so many kids being thrown out for lifelong times in preschool because of bad behavior. Now, it seems to me that's something very important in parenting. Proper learning of behaviors that are proper in surroundings with other people is something that a parent should teach, not a teacher, not a school system in any way. And in all the reporting, they just really glossed over that and kind of made it sound like maybe a teacher should teach that. I think it's something that's very important. It should be talked about in a program like this. Thank you very much, sirs.
All right.
You know, thank you. That was on my list, too. Yeah, it's in the news. It was a Yale study. Like one in a thousand 3- and 4-year-olds are being expelled from preschool. Most of these were private preschools instead of the public school system. And you say, wait a minute, 1 in 1,000, that's not very many. But okay, how many thousands are there in a million? And how many million of these kids do we have? So we've got a lot of kids being kicked out of school. And several months ago, a lady called on this show that her 18-month-old was kicked out of a preschool for biting. And you say, hey, 18-month-olds do bite. And yeah, do we have, number one, do we have unreasonable expectations of our kids' behaviors? Also of this data, I think it was 4-to-1 boys were being expelled over girls. And you say, well, you know what? We well know, and I just read a study in Scientific American comparing the female brain and the male brain, and they are different. I don't want to get into what the Harvard president got into trouble with, who's brighter, because I think this study had nothing to do with who's brighter. It's just that there are brain differences in the male and female, and so I think there are differences. We know it's been scientifically proven there are differences between boys and girls since day one. Do we have unreasonable expectations of boys over girls? Do we want our boys to behave like little ladies, which isn't going to happen? And I absolutely agree with you. Where are these kids' parents? And you know, we're talking about three-year-olds. Okay, well, how about the first 2 years of life? How often are these kids having dinner with their parents at home instead of at a fast food restaurant? How much time are these kids, are these parents spending with the kids saying, okay, it's reading time now, so I'm just, you know, we're going to turn off TV and it's just going to kind of be quiet and I'm going to read a story to you. And as you get older, if you pick up a word, you just pop in and help me read the story. And yeah, we're going to have dinner together and I'm going to show you how to use a spoon and a fork. And wait a minute, you can't throw mashed potatoes at your brother. That's just wrong. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, the schools, I think the schools deserve some of the blame. You know, they're expelling these kids. And in our local paper, they talked about where they had access to psychologists and social workers. They figured out why these kids were misbehaving and could intervene with it. But I absolutely agree with you. Child rearing begins from day one in the home by the parents. And I think many of these kids from an early age are in daycare or something from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. I've heard of. And you know, I think, yeah. Are the schools failing? Well, I'm not sure the schools are always doing the best job, but are parents failing? I absolutely am inclined to agree with you. I think in many cases, parents are failing. Years, decades ago, when I was in the Navy, we used to take our kids to the officers' club for dinner. And I'd hear in the office later on, gee, your kids are so well behaved. Well, they weren't that. You
used to come over to our house.
Yeah, they were kids. But, you know, people would say, how do you get your kids to behave at dinner? Well, we always used to have dinner together. And you'd say, you know, what do you do? Well, my husband gets home from work. He's tired. He wants the kids in bed. So we put the kids to bed, and then we have dinner together. And you say, well, okay, these kids have never seen adults eating, so they've never learned social etiquette at the table. No wonder you wouldn't take them out to dinner anyplace other than McDonald's so they can cram down their hamburger and go into playroom. And I think you're absolutely right. I think, yeah. Child rearing begins with parenting, and yeah, I'm willing to put some blame on the schools, but again, I think child rearing begins with the parents.
You know, one of the questions I had about this and is what is the nature of the problematic behavior that got the kids tossed out? The thing that really strikes me, looking at a story about it, is, well, first of all, the basic fact here, one of the things that's important, is that preschool kids are three times as likely to be expelled as kids in kindergarten through the 12th grade. So
yeah.
We're talking about that. And that the expulsion rates were lowest in preschool classrooms in public schools and in Head Start, and they were highest in faith-affiliated centers, in for-profit child care, and other community-based child care settings. Now, to me, one of the things that this says is that there are some places that feel they can toss the kids and other places that feel they can't. And I guess that's my question, is that, you know, are some of these kids being tossed because they can be tossed? And, you know, how bad are these kids?
I had the same feeling you did. I haven't seen the Yale study, but I had the same feeling you did that, okay, in Head Start and the public schools, we're sort of stuck with them. And then, yeah, in a for-profit school, we're sort of not stuck with them. We can toss them out of here. And I think the other thing that I got out of this data was that the public schools had access to social workers and psychologists, so they could get together and talk with the parents and talk with the teachers and say, all right, this is what Johnny's doing. Sometimes this is what Sally's doing, but mostly this is what Johnny's doing. Let's see if we can scratch our heads together and see if we can figure out why Johnny's doing this. And see if we can, fix why Johnny's doing this.
Yeah, that's one of the things here. I'm on the website of this is the New York Times. So this is a story that was published a couple days ago. And that is one of the points that the story makes, is that the expulsions were about twice as common in classrooms where the teachers had no access to a child psychologist or psychiatrist as in those where they did. So it may also be a case that if that teacher feels that he or she doesn't know what to do, has no help, has nowhere to turn to, then maybe they'd be more likely to say, look, I can't deal with this child. There's nobody here that can help me than he. And as you say, it is more likely going to be he's got to go.
And I think the other thing about especially the federal programs, they're more used to dealing with the lower socioeconomic classes. And unfortunately, and this is absolutely true, these kids seem to be more poorly socialized. So I think they're more used to these kids and they're more used to dealing with them.
Well, questions here are common or welcome on the show. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. Our guest is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, clinical assistant professor at University of Illinois, has been for many, many years now here on the show on a regular basis, always on a Thursday, once a month, and we invite questions on children's health. So anything that's on your mind, anything that has to do with kids, their health, their behavior, their development, the kinds of things that you would talk about with a pediatrician are certainly welcome on this show. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
But Johnny's not a rotten kid.
There is no such thing.
There is no such thing as a rotten kid.
As a rotten kid. I was going to ask you a little bit earlier because of the discussion we had about meningitis and so forth. I had this experience earlier this spring, a few weeks back, where one day I woke up with a really fierce sore throat and swollen glands in my throat. And it was bad enough, so I figured, okay, I got to go get checked out. So I march myself over to the doctor. Doctor looks me over, and she says, well, I think that you have strep throat. And she says, and I think I don't want to take the time to do the culture. I'm going to write your prescription for antibiotics. Take these, and you'll be okay. And I was a little surprised, based on all the discussions I've had with you and so many other doctors, about how casual we are in giving out antibiotics. But I was feeling terrible, and I didn't want to wait either. And I figured, well, doctor knows best, and so fine. And I marched off and got my antibiotics. And eventually, it did go away, although it was kind of slow. And actually, we talked about that a little bit. And you said, to me, this sounds like it was probably not strep throat. It was something else. So that gets me around to this conversation about, okay, so you got your kid. You got your kid with a sore throat. You march them down to the doctor. What now is the standard practice in terms of doing a culture, trying to have an actual diagnosis before you write the piece of paper for the antibiotic?
That was my training, and I think that's still the training. Decades later, it's still, know what you're treating. And I think especially in this day and age where maybe we're somewhat over-concerned about antibiotics selecting out resistant bacteria. I mean, strep's still a nice critter. You throw about $7 worth of penicillin at it, and it tends to die. But you got to know it's strep, and if it's not strep, and a throw culture costs you about $10 or $15. So you get in a little trouble there. But this is my bias again. I think what we're doing with medicine is we're throwing tests and chemicals at people to save time. Because then we can cramp more patients in per day and, you stamp out more widgets at the day and, there's more revenue. I didn't say that. But I think
you retired. You can say that.
I can say that. I think to a certain extent that's what's going on.
Well, how long? Suppose that they had decided to do this and take a culture and see what it actually. How long would it take?
How long would it take? 5 seconds to do the culture? You can get the culture results back. If you order it stat, you can get it back in an hour. If you don't order it stat, the lab will have it back by the end of the day. You can get them started on penicillin, and probably by the next morning they're feeling somewhat better. Mm-hmm. And certainly by the next day they're probably almost fully functional again. Hmm. So, my eyes, even when they were sharp, still couldn't see strep.
You just can't tell just by looking at it?
Just can't tell by looking.
You can't look in someone's throat and tell?
Occasionally you can say probably, I would give you 90% the way this throat looks, it's strep. But with 100% in a throat culture, I can give you 100% that this is strep. And that this antibiotic that an antibiotic should be used. And again, my feeling is penicillin VK is the drug of choice. It's about $7 for 10 days. You do have to take it for 10 days. That's the disadvantage. But for $7, 10 days worth of taking it 3 times a day, you will be well. And you can use one of the macrolides, one of the newer drugs, where you only have to take it for 3 days, but you're going to pay about, 3 or 4 times the cost. And you're also using a broader spectrum antibiotic, so you may be causing that antibiotic to become worthless sooner than it will anyway.
Okay, so if you had this experience, your parent, kid, sore throat, take him to the doctor. Doctor looks, get over, said, well, I think it's probably strep, so here you go, here's some antibiotic. Do you as a parent say, well, hold up a minute there, doctor. Don't you really think we should do a culture and be sure?
Yes.
So you would say to parents,
I think
that would be a good thing.
Or I'd think about finding another doctor. I think there are exceptions. Okay, sibling had confirmed strep throat. Younger brother or older brother or somebody 3 days later has a sore throat, and you say, you know what? I know there's strep in this family. I will assume that this is strep. And I will not culture the second child because I know strep's in the family, and I know that the time is short enough that, this is strep. I don't need to gag this child too.
All right. Well, we got some other calls here. Let's go on. We have next someone to talk with in Indiana, and it's line number 4 right here. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'd like to get back to the lymph nodes. Just coincidentally, a few days ago, a member of the family, a young boy, about 11, going on 12, was complaining to his mother about when he turned his head, it hurt a little bit down by his neck, and then they got a hold of me, and I'm educated, so they think I know everything. Of course, I have to fudge it a lot. But we have a lot of hay fever, asthma, that kind of thing in the family. And usually these things are brushed under, just sort of like, wait a few days, it'll go down. And it did. I guess over a period of 5 days, he started noticing it. By the end of the fifth day, it was gone. But what I was concerned about is when he talked, he moved his head. He's not an unintelligent boy, and he described it as something like a bump rolling over something, that when he turned his head and there was a particular place where it was, sort of painful.
Okay.
No fever, no inflammation of the throat or inside the mouth or anything like that. And so I guess we basically all put it off as, one of the family problems that we all had, and, I've experienced that thing too. And I showed him where the lymph nodes are underneath the jawline on the right, and they're easy to feel. but it was a little bit lower down on the throat he was talking about. So that's, and you've been talking about it, and I thought I would ask you that question. I presume there's more lymph nodes underneath the jawline than just those two large ones that you can easily feel.
And oh, there's those, hundreds of them. Yeah.
Yeah, and one of those was probably swollen.
Yeah.
And, I got at sort of the end of it, and I sort of poked around a little bit, and he didn't complain about any residual pain or anything. Like, you know, you want to get outside and hit the ball, and so I just sort of said, well, it's just one of those things we run into, and, you know, I suggested to his mother that if it lasts longer, you know, than 5 days, you better get a hold of a doctor, because she was sort of concerned about some kind of, you know, throat problem, and so we sort of left it there, and I just thought maybe, you know, you could do a few sentences about that kind of situation or what you thought it might be. I guess the corollary question is, if it's the lymph node in a particular place, does that mean that the bacteria or whatever are close to that area?
Yeah, usually it will be in the so-called draining lymph nodes. And yeah, lymph tends to flow certain ways and drains toward the regional lymph nodes. So, okay, you get an infection on your arm. The lymph nodes in your armpit are gonna enlarge. You get an infection on your leg, you cut your leg, it gets infected. Usually the lymph nodes in the groin are the ones that are gonna enlarge. So, it will be the draining lymph nodes. I guess the other question about this particular boy was it musculoskeletal? Did he do something to strain neck muscle or something like that?
Oh, we tried that angle, and gosh, I don't know, Mom.
That's right.
You know,
he's a busy, active boy.
Yeah. So that's where it was. And I guess I felt a little, I don't know, not peeved, but just a little concerned that she didn't take him to the doctor directly. Then I remembered, I started thinking about my past. And God, I think when I was a little boy, I went to the doctor a few times. And after that, the doctor said, look, you know, give it a few days, because all you guys, you know, you have allergic reactions. They were practically everybody in the family on one side, and I guess he was passed on to him is the presumption now. But I just wanted to make sure that all of us did sort of like the right thing without any great problems. He seems to be fine now, and
yeah.
I asked him to come back, and I sort of poked around his neck a little more, robustly, and he complained about, hey, you know, that. Don't do that. That hurt my throat there.
You know,
it wasn't the pain he was, and it wasn't really what he said. It was just a presence of fullness, I guess
yes.
you'd say.
And I think you're right. If it was, you know, self-limited, two or three to four, yeah, mm-hmm. 2 days it was getting better, 3 days it was gone, that's fine. And I think the other thing, I think we want to pay attention to the system of symptoms. Okay, we've got a lymph node. What else have we got going on? Is the lymph node tender or is it non-tender? Is it one lymph node? Is it two lymph nodes? Does this patient have a fever? Is this patient losing weight? Does this patient have night sweats? Does this patient have a sore throat or what else is going on? So I think more often than not, we don't want to pay attention to a symptom. We want to pay attention to the system of symptoms.
Okay.
And again, it goes back to the strep throat. We want to start with a good history of what's going on, how long's it been going on, and then a good physical exam. What do I find on physical exam? Do I find one lymph node? How does it feel? Is it smooth? Is it mobile? Is it unattached? Okay, then and everything else looks okay. Okay, then I'm not going to worry about it. I'm going to tell you if it persists, gets larger, come back to me. But if this patient is having, if it's big and feels knobby and fixed to the tissues, and they're having night sweats and weight loss, I'm going to say, uh-oh, I got to think about Hodgkin's disease here. So I think, the total history and the total physical exam is important. Then the lab and x-ray is the next thing. And that's the classic thing we were taught in medical school. It's still the classic thing taught going on. And I think, if we have one lymph node that feels a little larger than the one on the other side, I think what you did is perfectly fine. I'm just going to watch this because there doesn't seem to be anything else much going on. I'm just going to watch it. And if it's a little better in a couple of days and it's gone in 4 or 5 days, hey, I don't know what it was. but I don't care what it was.
Okay.
It took care of itself.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician and is with us on the program once a month, always on a Thursday, to talk about children's health. The number, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. And that's for Champaign-Urbana folks. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have some other callers here in Champaign. We'll go to line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, good morning, Dr. Bocek.
Good morning.
My main question, I'm going to hold for a second. I want to get back to that meningococcal question. Is there some vaccine that can be given to children?
Yes, there's a new protein conjugate vaccine. It's approved for 13 and up at the moment.
13?
Yeah.
Okay.
At the moment. I think part of that problem is because it hasn't been tested much on the lower age group, and that's a common age. Adolescents and early college years is a common age group. And I think the other problem is there's sort of a limit on the amount of vaccine now. So I look for... In the finite future, the next couple of years, that the age will be broadened out, and it may very well start in infancy that we'll start administering this vaccine.
Yeah. Well, I've got a 3.5 and a 5-year-old grandsons. My question that I was calling about initially was it concerns. Well, I can talk freely because they're out of state.
Okay.
My son-in-law won't get bent out of shape. Their scheduling is awful. They don't have a schedule.
Okay.
They don't sit down for dinner. If they don't eat dinner, the father will come in and make buttered popcorn for them or 2 pieces of cake or whatever. I am the mother-in-law.
Uh-oh.
So I have to really be careful, and I'm wondering if there is some kind of, if there is a book out. This older child is going to be starting kindergarten in the fall. He definitely needs a nap. He gets very grouchy in the afternoon, but sometimes does not get a nap because of the scheduling problems, and doesn't go to bed until maybe 10 or 11 at night. And I am very, very worried. You're talking about kids getting kicked out of preschool. I can just see him getting kicked out of kindergarten because he's falling asleep during the day. Is there some way that you can suggest that I can provide them with some counseling or a book that maybe will help them? I'm mainly concerned because both of the adults, my daughter included, are obese, and the children now are looking healthy, but they're on a road to disaster.
They eat, fast foods.
Well, they know where the
whatever.
Junk food is, and it's always there, and they just go in and get it, and I'm only down there every 3 months, and when I'm down there, it's fine. We sit down, we have nice scheduled
meals,
dinners and everything, but I know what their usual schedule is, and it's non-scheduled. So I'm just wondering if there's any way that I can help them in some way that's not going to alienate me from the family.
You want me to make you feel worse?
Well, yeah.
Statistically, if the mother's obese, I think the kids have about an 80% chance of being obese, and if both parents are obese, I think it goes up to close to 100%.
And it is just because they buy huge quantities.
Okay.
They don't need it.
They probably buy huge quantities, and I suspect they buy inappropriate foods, too.
Well, it's a lot of high-fat things.
Yes, a lot of fried foods, a lot of fat, either a lot of fast foods or fast-like foods.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I just want to take them to Canada then.
Yeah. I think my best advice is you're the grandmother, not the parents.
Right.
And I think you just need to be available. But I think, again, if you deluge them with materials or lectures, you're going to be the interfering mother-in-law, yeah. grandmother.
Yeah.
And I think my best advice to you is grit your teeth. Set the good example when you're there.
Mm-hmm.
Make suggestions, but don't give orders. And just be the good grandmother you are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when they're a little bit older, they'll be able to come up here and spend the summers with me. So.
Yeah.
And then we'll do the fish on the grill.
Yeah. Get them plenty of omega-3 fatty acids. Yeah. It's too bad. I also suspect both these parents work.
Well, yeah. Well, they actually just moved to a new location.
Okay.
So it's a transition
yeah.
situation, which is, you know, very stressful
okay.
for them. But even when they were situated, I noticed that their food consumption was... my son-in-law will dish out dinners for the kids in quantities that are...
Huge.
Sufficient for a healthy adult.
Are they expected to clean their plates?
No.
Good.
No.
Okay, that's
no.
fine. That's more encouraging.
Yeah.
But what's discouraging is the buttered popcorn and the, okay, you didn't eat supper, you get two pieces of chocolate cake.
Oh, yeah, whatever they want.
Yeah.
Well, you know, another subject entirely, but my son-in-law is adopted, and I think that he's always suffered from this, I was not loved, and I'm going to love my children to the max.
Okay, but he doesn't know how.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I mean, bless his heart, he's trying the best he knows,
well,
but he doesn't know how. I guess the other thing is, can you know, for gifts, maybe buy him balls and bats or frisbees or...
Oh, I never buy them junk.
Okay. Yeah, stuff that will encourage them to get out and play.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The thing that's scary to me is they are so beautiful right now, and they're in such good shape right now. But I can see their habits are not good, and I'm especially worried about the older one going to kindergarten and not being on a schedule where you sit down together, have dinner, take your bath, and go to bed.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And I think that, you know, I personally think that's important. Again, like, it goes back to our earlier conversation about these 1 in 1,000 kids being kicked out of school.
Right.
And I think dinner together is an important time. It's a time of sharing manners. It's a time of sharing daily experiences. It's a time of verbal interaction. It's a time to share problems and say, you know, this is the situation I got into today. This is what I did to get out of it. Are there any? Yeah.
No,
does anybody have any comments?
Isn't this really the most important stage of their lives is before they go to school? I think the bonding with the family, the, you know, to know that you're on a routine that you can depend on.
Yeah, let's just say I'm not sure it's the most important stage, but yes, I think it's an important stage of their life. The other thing I like to tell parents is if you haven't done your job by the time they turn into be teenagers, you're in a little bit of trouble. And that's not fully true. I mean, we still have great input with our teenagers, but teenage time is a time to separate from the parents to become independent.
Yeah.
And I think as parents, we have less influence at that time as peer influence gets to be greater.
Me. I know that.
And it's sort of a time as a parent to hang on and hope you did well the first 12 years.
I had to keep my mouth shut when my one daughter was 15. I don't think we really exchanged a lot between 15 and 16 and a half.
Yeah.
Okay. I can't say too much, but I'm here.
Just like my adult kids, they call and, you know, and my wife will say, well, what did you tell them to do? I said, you know, I didn't tell them to do anything. They weren't calling to ask me. They were calling to tell me what they've already decided. Yeah.
Oh, it never ends. I thought that my problems were over, but now I've got grandchildren to worry about.
I am told that is fun.
Well, I love them dearly, and I'll do everything for them. And Dr. Bocek, thank you.
You're welcome.
Hearing you.
Thanks for the call. We'll try to get real quick one more here. This is Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hi. I had a question regarding transitioning my daughter from nursing to whole milk. She just turned a year last Monday, and we tried to give her whole milk just to introduce it, and she wanted nothing to do with it.
Milk belongs in the breast.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't belong in a cup.
Right.
It doesn't belong in, and I'm sure she says, I don't want anything to do with the bottle.
You know, she was okay taking a bottle if I was away.
Yeah.
And she would take a bottle for me very infrequently, but for the most part, I was always with her to nurse her. So.
And, you know, I think my answer at that age again is don't worry about her milk intake.
Okay.
How is she doing with solid food, table food, and that sort of stuff?
You know, day to day, her favorite thing is oatmeal. So
okay.
We try to get plenty of oatmeal. We consider that like her junk food. I mean, she can't get
enough
of that. You know, some days are better than others. We try to make sure that, you know, she gets plenty of fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
But there are some days where it's almost like she's on a little strike and she doesn't want to eat too much. But then we make up for it the next day. So
yes.
From what I'm hearing, that's okay.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think, again, is she still terribly interested in the breast, or is she losing interest in the breast?
No, she enjoys the breast.
How many times a day?
She nurses, I would say, at least 4 times a day.
Okay. You know what? It sounds like she's not ready to transition yet.
Okay.
And I think most children will say, you know what? I've had enough of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Give me that cup. Give me that steak.
Mm-hmm.
And I think... I think you want to give up breastfeeding.
Well, I will be going back to work part-time
teaching
in the fall, so I'm
trying
to make the transition earlier rather than later to make it a little easier on
everyone. Yeah, so that'll take care of it. You know, the other helpful thing is summer.
Mm-hmm.
As you're outside, spending more time at the garden, the park, whatever you like to do, she's going to be busier at the garden, the park, whatever. She's eating worms, whatever she likes to do. And the breasts will just not occur to her. Or it will not be available to her.
Okay.
And I think this spring and summer is probably going to take care of your weaning problem, your transition problem.
Okay. And the other thing is, you know, because we tried it with a cup. I mean, because again, she really didn't have bottles. I can count probably
with
both hands how many times she actually had a bottle. So I didn't want to revert back to a bottle.
No. Why at this stage?
And then try to break her.
Yeah. Why do you want to wean from the breast to the bottle and then have to wean from the bottle to the cup?
Right.
It seems at this age that's you want to go from the breast to the cup.
Okay. And then about how much, once she does start transitioning, I was thinking about transitioning her to about like 4 ounces a day over a period and gradually build up. Would that be about right? Are they supposed to get about 16 ounces at her age of milk?
You know, again, I'm going to say that think of the food pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And don't think about milk. Think about dairy products.
Okay.
Think about cheese, yogurt, cottage cheese, all that stuff. And that's all in the dairy product group, and I think that's what you're talking about at that age. Not how many ounces of milk does she get?
Okay, and then just one more question regarding juices. We haven't given her juices yet. We just give her water and
mm-hmm.
then breast milk. Is there any reason to even introduce her to juices?
Probably not.
Okay.
What's juice? It's a squish fruit. If she eats fruit well, that's fine.
I'm going to have to jump in here. My